Good afternoon, you're very welcome to today's edition of Saturday with Clare Byrne. On today's programme, patients on hospital trolleys in winter. Why is such a predictable problem seemingly unsolvable? Emergency consultant Dr. Emily O'Connor tells our politicians what it will take to sort out. A new poll says Leo Varadkar would win more seats for Fine Gael than anyone else. Will it prompt a push against Enda? That and plenty more to come in the next hour. But first, the news now with Jan O'Connell.
Thanks, Clare.
Jan, thank you very much. This is Saturday with Clare Byrne and you're very welcome to the programme, and we'd like to get you to get in touch with us over the course of the next hour. The text number is 51551, the email address saturday@rte.ie, and the Twitter address is @SaturdayRTE. Joining us today from our Cork studio, we've Billy Kelleher, Fianna Fáil TD, Cork North Central and spokesperson on health. Here in our Dublin studio, Martin Kenny, Sinn Féin TD for Sligo Leitrim and spokesperson on agriculture, food and the marine. Peter Burke, Fine Gael TD for Longford Westmeath, Dr. Emily O'Connor, President of the Irish Association of Emergency Medicine and consultant at Connolly Hospital in Blanchardstown in Dublin, and Martina Devlin, author and Irish Independent columnist. You're all very welcome. Emily, I'm going to start with you because it's the story of the week, the trolley crisis. It happens every single year, and I was asking you just before we came on air, why does it happen shortly after Christmas, every January, that we have this build-up in our hospital wards? What are the reasons for it?
I suppose to start off with, it's been a crisis for 10 years, for over a decade. And this year has been busier all through the year. The attendances in Connolly Hospital were up 8.5%. We saw an extra 3,000 patients this year, and that's been the experience countrywide. Why does this happen at Christmas? Well, people get sick all year round, and there's lots of illness at Christmas time and New Year. We get through the Christmas period reasonably well in regard to trolley waits because hospital beds aren't occupied by patients undergoing elective surgery. And anyone who is at all able to get home is sent home because we value being at home for Christmas very highly. Once we get into the New Year period, we have been filling that capacity, that bed capacity, all through Christmas. And then elective surgery can start again, or other treatments start again that require hospital beds. So we always hit difficulties in the first week.
So you don't have the capacity to feed through those people who need admission?
There is no surge capacity in our system. Bed occupancy rates in Ireland run at a 100%. We need to be running at about 85% to build in any surge capacity. So even a very minor surge, which is the entirely predictable flu that happens every year, really brings us down, and we end up with lots of patients on trolleys.
So the flu is causes a minor surge?
Every year we have the flu. So if you look
at... So you can't attribute what happened this week to the flu?
Not all of it, no. So our rates of admissions for our flu-related, confirmed flu-related admissions for week 51 and 52 of 2016 were 173. If you compare that to the same week last year, they were lower last year, but by week three, they were at the same level. So I think that the flu came just a week or two earlier this year, but the levels are still what we would normally expect.
And how are things in your own hospital, in Connolly Hospital?
I'm very proud that we actually coped very well through the year. We've had very proactive bed management for the year, and our trolley waits have dramatically improved this year as compared to other years.
And what about in the past week when we saw over 600 people?
So I did. So let's say I did several long shifts in Christmas week and New Year's Day. We were already very busy in the run up to Christmas. We had lots of respiratory illness, not flu related, but lots of respiratory illness. So going in, let's say one of the long days I worked was the 29th. So you go in on the Thursday morning, and most of our major cubicles will be full with admitted patients. Just to tell you what it's like, you're looking at mainly much older patients over 65. There's a lot of coughing. There is a lot of noise. There's a lot of people calling for help. So it is a distressing environment for patients to spend a long period of time in. And then on top of that, we deal with 120 incoming that will come to us that day.
So these are people on these trolleys that you've described there who have been admitted. So they've been triaged, they've been seen, and a decision has been taken that they need to be admitted to hospital.
Yes.
They're just sitting there or lying there waiting.
They
are
an inpatient at this stage.
Okay.
And they have been seen by multiple layers of medical staff, and a decision has been made that, they need an acute hospital bed, and there is none for them.
It's distressing, isn't it, Martina, even to hear that description?
It's horrible. Yeah. It sounds like MASH without the helicopters. 10 years ago, I was in a position that's just been described, waiting to be admitted to hospital for 20 hours on a trolley. And what shocks me is exactly what happened to me then and what I saw all around me, people calling for help, people groaning, is what's being described now. So there has been no change, no improvement. And what we can see is that the emergency department is moving closer and closer to the front door of the hospital, and it's spilling out into the ambulance waiting area. And how long, really? I should think it's the fear for every hospital manager and every doctor before someone dies in one of those ambulances or waiting to be dealt with in the emergency department. And there's a blockage, really, in the system, and it's at two ends. One of the blockages appears to be moving people on into the wards. You know, as we've just heard, they've been admitted, but there's no bed for them to go into. And so you've got this absolute overcrowding in the emergency department. And I'm wondering if, for example, one way around it might not be to have just a little bit of overcrowding in wards. So a ward of 12 beds, put in another one or two and share the overcrowding, mm-hmm. rather than have 100% overcrowding in the emergency room. So that's at one end. And then at the other end, where people are the walking wounded, if you like, and the doctor is ready to discharge them and wants to discharge them, but into what? That's a whole care in the community question. You know, we hear that there's lots of funds are being put into the health service, but has it been taken, especially during the collapse, from low-hanging fruit, from home helps, and from all sorts of assisted living in people's own home, which they want anyway. Most people would prefer mm-hmm. to stay in their own home, but with a bit of help from the state, and all that funding really was attacked.
Emily, can I ask you about that? Because that would seem like an obvious solution, the first outline there by Martina. Put a few more people on each of the wards. Does that happen?
Yes. So I think if you look at the Trolley Guard, the INMO statistics that they produce every day, you will see that many hospitals around the country split their trolleyed patients between the emergency department and the wards. And it's very easy to see that split. It's listed out. But there are still some hospitals that hold all their trolley patients within the four walls of the emergency department. What Martine is describing is what we call the full capacity protocol, which has been, it's been widely published as being the safer way. It mitigates the risk to patients on trolleys by spreading the load of boarded patients throughout the hospital. As Martina describes, putting one or two extra patients on each ward. That does happen in Connolly Hospital and in some hospitals around the country, but isn't happening in all hospitals.
Why?
I can't answer that because I am not aware of the management structures in those hospitals. I know that many of my nursing colleagues would feel that it isn't the long-term solution to a problem. But from an emergency, that because they want the capacity problem addressed properly. But we would feel that having all these trolleyed patients within the four walls of the emergency department, looked after simply by emergency nurses, and the literature would prove that it is safer to spread those patients around the hospital.
Okay. Could I just pop in there? There's another issue which some doctors have explained to me, which is that you're in a very dangerous no man's land once you've been admitted. A ward is ready to accept you, but there's no bed, because at this stage you're under no doctor or nurse, really. You know, the emergency doctors have dealt with you and they've moved on. The surgical or medical ward doctor can't actually look after you because you're not in that ward. And it's a very dangerous time, and studies in other countries certainly would show that if you spend all your time as a patient in the emergency department, you're going to have a worse outcome.
Okay, Billy Keller, can I come to you on that solution that was suggested by Martina? And we heard from Emily that it's happening, i.e. spreading the overcrowding to the wards. It's happening in some hospitals, but not all. Now, Minister Simon Harris got into trouble with some people by suggesting that senior hospital managers should be held accountable and sanctioned if they're underperforming, particularly in these crisis times. It would seem that the senior hospital managers may be responsible for not carrying out that function in all hospitals around the country.
Well, yes, I mean, full capacity protocol is in operation in a lot of hospitals, but it does need discussion, negotiations between worker representatives, unions, clinicians and the management. And so not every hospital has come to an agreement on it. It certainly would make sense from the point of view that we now have a situation where not only is the emergency department overcrowded, we actually have people inside in ambulances who can't be discharged into the emergency department. So it would make sense in terms of crisis management to move patients into the ward setting to lighten the burden in the emergency department so people can be discharged from ambulances, etc. But I mean, that doesn't resolve the longer term problems because it does, you know, put people at risk in terms of, you know, ratios of nurses to patients and nurses to beds. All of these things are internationally recognised. So, you know, the idea that you can just keep shepherding or herding people into the hospital without actually having an increase in nursing staff longer term would put patients at risk as well. I think the biggest problem here, look, you know, we can all blame ministers and oppositions will certainly do that from time to time, but we've been consistently, you know, reducing the capacity and the ability of our health services over the last number of years. We've reduced the bed capacity of our public health system, our acute hospital beds. And in the meantime, we've also been reducing the capacity of primary care and community care. So all in all, with the increasing population, with the changes in demographics, you know, people should never be surprised when we have these huge problems, particularly in January, February, March of every year for the last number of years.
Yeah, but it's not a new problem. I mean, let me read you this. Up to 400 patients are on trolleys and chairs every day awaiting hospital beds. They've been assessed by an appropriate doctor and require admission. That is from the Irish Examiner in April 2005. And Fianna Fáil had been in power for 8 years at that stage, and most of the 10 before that. I mean, this is a problem that you guys couldn't deal with either.
But I've just made that point, Claire. I'm just highlighting the facts that if you keep reducing bed numbers, if you keep trying to do the same thing over and over again, you're going to get the same
result.
But
if you know that's wrong, why did Fianna Fáil do that?
Well, we didn't reduce the bed numbers as much as has happened in recent times. I mean, for example, Dr. James Riley, when he became the minister, said that bed capacity wasn't the real issue, that there was smarter ways of dealing with it. But the bottom line here is, look, we have an increasing population. We have an ageing profile in the population. We have more complexities out there. Surgeries have become more complex. You know, dealing with patients have become more complex. So we do need to increase the bed capacity. But in doing that, you also need to address the issue of primary care and community care. And primary care just simply is not capable of dealing with what is thrown at it on a daily basis in our surgeries or GP surgeries across the country. They're understaffed, they're under-resourced. The ageing profile of our GPs isn't, you know, long-term sustainable. So on two fronts, we have a situation where people end up in the emergency department because they can't be treated elsewhere in a more appropriate setting, and that's where they should be treated. For example, I mean, Minister Harrison, I think his choice of words was not great, but he said that elderly people should stay away from the emergency department. Elderly people are referred to the emergency department by GPs. Now, the problem here is that they shouldn't be if there was a more appropriate setting for dealing with them in the nursing home or in the home care setting, where you could have IVs available, where you would have, you know, that could be administered in that setting. But very often, they're transferred by ambulance into a very stressful place, which is the emergency department. And probably, well, Dr. O'Connor could obviously deal with this better than me, but it certainly would seem to be the less appropriate place for that type of care. So we have to think beyond what we're doing presently and accept that some things that we've consistently repeated over and over and again will just get the same result, and that means more people on trolleys every January, February and March when winter vomiting bug sets in and when the flu sets in.
OK, I'm just wondering about that suggestion. We've heard it a few times during the week that, you know, if elderly people could be treated in their nursing home setting, that they should be. Why wouldn't they be if that were possible?
Well, most of the nursing homes here in the country are GP-led services, and they don't have the facilities there for instance, intravenous antibiotics, stuff like that, which should be done there, aren't been done there, can't be done there, and they end up in the emergency departments. I spoke to somebody in Sligo during the week where they had a huge crisis last weekend. They've worked their way through it, and they've got it down now that it's reasonably manageable. But that's what they were saying, that a lot of the patients that were there were people that actually came in from nursing homes that were, some people would say, clogging it up or whatever. But they're people that have a real problem and have to get it sorted out, and there's no other way of doing it.
So if you boosted the care services in the nursing home and allowed some of those treatments to happen there, then
and even
need to send them in.
Even in our mental health hospitals, in our mental health services, a lot of the services that need, because a lot of elderly people are there as well, and they can't get those kind of services there, and yet there are qualified people there and practitioners there that could do that, but they're not allowed to do it. They have to go into the general hospitals to do it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is crisis there which can be resolved, I suppose, through management. But the big issue, and the big issue that everyone has to face, is that we have over 800 less beds in our public service now than we had in 2008. And that's what we need to do. We need to change that. And it's not just the bed, it's not just the mattress and the base. You know, it's the services around it. It's the nurses, it's the care assistants, it's all of that. And it's employing additional people to ensure that those frontline services are provided. And that's what we need to do up and down the country.
I'm sure people will be wondering as they hear that, you know, what we do with the $14 billion that we spend on health every year.
We provide an excellent service with it, but unfortunately, we don't provide enough in that particular part of it. And one of the things that I think is dangerous here is that there's an element of it coming into it that we're talking about, you know, going the private route, that the private hospitals are somehow the answer to this. You know, I don't think that's the answer to it. I don't think people should be said, you know, if you have the money, you can go to the private way, but if you don't, unfortunately, you'll have to queue the other way. I don't think that's the answer. I think the answer is a long-term plan that the government puts in place to provide a proper health service for all of our people. And in the meantime, in the short term, what we need to do is to relook at a whole management structure, how all this is done, and in regard to the nursing homes, in regard to other services we provide, and the GPs and what they can do in the primary care centres.
More money. Peter, your own area, I was just looking at what was going on in Mullingar. So you've got 20 beds closed in Mullingar Hospital. So the number of beds available is down to 204 from 24 5 years ago. So that's obviously going to cause some pressure. And the downgrading of services at Navan and Roscommon, according to your constituency colleague, although not party colleague, Robert Troy from Fianna Fáil, that there hasn't been contingency to deal with that. Do you agree with that?
I don't fully agree with that. First of all, I just want to acknowledge it's been a very distressful week for patients and their families, for our clinicians, for our nursing staff and our healthcare attendants. So I just want to acknowledge that before I begin. Just in relation to the figures there, obviously we're increasing the budget this year, 2017, by €1 billion in our health service. In relation to Mullingar, as you mentioned, we have an excellent manager down there, Shauna Sheeman, and staff who have made huge efforts this week. So as a result of the winter initiative, the €40 million that was allocated, we've got to open Ward 4, which is a 10-bedded unit. And that provides essentially care between 8 and 5. And what has happened since last Thursday, in relation to the additional announcements, is that two nursing staff have been hired and will commence working next Monday, which will increase the hours we can cater for those people. So Mullingar, at the moment, is now in the green zone. It's in the clear. It's had a very difficult week, I would acknowledge that, and the staff have made huge efforts. But I think we have to be very honest in relation to this debate. So first of all, if we drill down deeper in terms of bed capacity, at the moment I think we use 3.5 million beds per year. If going by our demographics and how we're going to change over the next 30 years, I think the Director General made a very valid point in that that will increase to 6.4 million days. So essentially we spend approximately $5.3 billion in our public hospitals. Doubling that would mean we would get double capacity over those 30 years. Obviously, that's not sustainable. So we have to get a solution to that. And I think the solution is investing heavily in our primary care. We need to treat people near the home. We need to ensure that we get a new GP contract signed in 2017. I think the Minister has made that a priority. We also need to increase our nursing staff. We've made a commitment that in 2017, we're going to hire an additional 1,000 nurses. And also on top of that,
they don't seem to want to come though, Peter. Isn't that the problem?
Well, how we will answer that is we need to provide pathways for their progression. We need to ensure that they can see where they're going.
They want more money and they want better conditions.
But also we need to ensure that there's avenues to make them advanced nursing practitioners whereby they can get more involved in medicine and discharging patients. We also need to ensure that our health service keeps spending money more efficiently and better. And obviously the Minister has made it clear that in quarter one of this year there will be a review of the bed capacity which will be completed, and obviously it needs to be scientifically and evidence-based. So we know the locations where the beds are needed, we know the type of bed that's needed. So there is a lot of work going on and we need to continue to pursue a 10-year health plan for a health service to create certainty and that we have continuity when ministers change.
Emily, what do you think of all that?
So it's just, first of all, it's great to hear. I think we've turned a corner in the debate, in the talking about our trolley problems this year. I suppose over the last 10 years, we haven't been listened to when we've talked about increasing capacity. All we were allowed to talk about was changing processes. And processes have changed and improved. It's fantastic to hear everyone coming on board finally in 2017 to agree that we need more acute bed capacity in our system. And what we need is that followed through on. The trolley waits will go out of the media within the next couple of days. And I don't want to be in the same position next year where everyone's shocked again in January next year because we're back in the same place. We need the plans that are being put in place implemented. We have lots of paperwork on our desks about plans that should happen, and what we need of them is them implemented. I know that in the Winter Initiative, 55 beds were supposed to open. Only 17 of them they actually managed to open. So there is a gap between the plans that are being outlaid and the implementation of those plans. I would agree that primary care needs to be built up. The mass majority of healthcare in the country is in primary care. But I will say no amount of primary care will reduce the number of patients who need a bed in the hospital at this stage. So we need to grasp the nettle of acute capacity. We need to put in enough beds so that when someone has finished their assessment in the emergency department, it's been decided they need a hospital bed, that there is one there for them.
So when you hear people saying that elderly people who are coming from nursing homes could, if you boosted services there, be treated in that nursing home and not have to be admitted to hospital, you don't think that is the case?
It would be my experience that patients are sent from nursing homes to emergency departments, but we need to recognise that people do require treatment. Nursing homes vary in their ability to provide more advanced levels of treatment. There is some very good practice in some nursing homes, but most of them can't give intravenous antibiotics. So patients do get transferred when they have sepsis and they need intravenous antibiotics. I think that can be very distressing for a lot of older people, particularly those with cognitive impairment. They're moved out of their routine environment into what can be quite a distressing environment in the emergency department. So there's two things there. One is to up the level of care that can be delivered in nursing homes. And second, there's a societal decision that needs to be made about the priorities in someone's life if they're in their last few weeks of their life, and whether or not more invasive levels of treatment is more appropriate for them than perhaps more palliative measures.
Which could be carried out in the nursing home.
And that's a societal move we need to make. We all need to think about our own futures, about the futures of our loved ones and what we want for them and what they want for themselves in their last few weeks and months of life.
Martina, you want to come back in?
Yeah, there's a terrific book by a US doctor called Being Mortal. Mm. The doctor's name is Atul Gawande. I'm probably pronouncing it wrongly. But it's about the last chapter of life. And it talks about how a structural solution and a societal solution is needed, about ways for people to make their own decisions, even if they're flawed decisions. So, for example, keeping people in their own homes where they're going to be happier, because it's about well-being, even if there's a risk that in their own homes they'll fall. People fall in hospitals too. You can't keep people wrapped in cotton wool and incredibly safe. It's just not possible. I know my mother had a massive stroke and we made a decision to look after her in the home. I'm from a family of seven kids, so there were a lot of us. But it took all seven of us on a rota basis to keep her at home. And it was very hard work. And she went in occasionally into respite into a local nursing home. And the staff were doing their best. Don't get me wrong, they were committed to what they were doing. But that really was what people call God's waiting room. People in those nursing homes were waiting to die. Whereas when you saw people in their own homes, there was just a sense of being loved and cared for. And I couldn't recommend it strongly enough, but I do stress that there were seven of us.
Yes, it's not always possible.
It's not always possible.
To do that. Selective analysis.
The state can help. You know, and when we were struggling, we asked for help, you know, and
you got it.
We did sometimes, yeah, if you complained loud enough.
Cathal says on Twitter, selective analysis, no mention of the skeleton medical staff over Christmas and New Year, huge numbers of locums. Do you want to comment on that, Emily, or no?
Yeah, sure, sure. So our society values very highly Christmas, New Year as a period of holiday. In the emergency department, we recognise that our workload remains the same. So we by no means had skeleton staff. Nursing rosters were full, and most days except for Christmas Day and New Year's Day, we were staffed as per normal medically. Yes, we did go down to one consultant on call on Christmas Day and on New Year's Day, but other than that, we were fully staffed. I can't speak for the rest of the hospital, but we recognise patients continue to come into us at very high levels over that period. So our emergency departments were staffed.
That battle, though, to get consultants to work longer hours and more antisocial hours, that's been running for a long time and doesn't seem to be getting anywhere.
So, yeah, so just to put in context, first of all, from an ED point of view, there are less than 80 consultants in emergency medicine for 29 emergency departments. So if you're what you need to provide extended day working or out of hours working for consultants is numbers. The Irish Association of Emergency Medicine have started some preliminary work on laying out the staffing we would like and the increase in breadth and depth it would give to consultant cover. So by breadth and depth, I mean the breadth is the length of time there is consultant in the emergency department, and the depth is the multiple streams, whether you're running a clinical decision unit, you're teaching, you're training, all the different streams that consultants deliver. We in Connolly have adopted a very proactive approach, so we have a consultant on the floor 12 hours a day, 5 days a week. And we also have consultant delivered clinical decision unit and ambulatory streams. Now, that's with five consultants. If you want us to get up to 7 days a week, our recommendation would be that a department needs 10 to 12 consultants. In Belfast, they're running the Belfast Royal, they're running 16 hour a day, 7 days a week consultant presence in the emergency department with 16 consultants. So they're the numbers
and
we're talking about.
How would that relate in size to Connolly Hospital?
Big hospital, the Royal Victoria?
Yeah, they're seeing about just over 100,000 ED attendances a year. Connolly Hospital, we saw 37,000 this year. The likes of Limerick is seeing over 60,000 a year. So yeah, there are economies of scale, and that's where reconfiguration is the word at the moment. And that's something that as a country we're going to have to bite the bullet on.
So if you want more cover, you're saying we need more consultants.
Well, I don't think as a country we can afford 16 consultants for each 29 emergency department.
Okay. Right.
Or perhaps we can. Perhaps maybe the politicians might tell me we can.
Martin Kenny, you want to come back in there?
There's just a couple of points I want to come to there. And the issue of the 55 new nursing posts that were promised and only 17 of them have come. I think when this all ends and the trolley crisis is over, because the trolley crisis is really, if you like, the symptom of a bigger problem that's in the health service. And, you know, it's all in our attention for the last week. It'll die away, and over the next 6 and 8 months, you know, okay, occasionally there'll be a bit of rumpus about waiting lists or about whatever, but the real crisis won't come to a boil again until we have this trolley crisis again. And the issue is, and I know the minister said, I think he was 68 new nurses they were hoping to recruit. The problem is those 68 are not new. What they are doing is they are replacing 68 that are probably already employed as under other measures that are there through
So you're saying they're not
the agency staff.
Yeah.
That they bring in agency staff and they replace them with full-time ones, and they say we've taken new ones. That's not the way to do it. What we need is new staff, and we need to have hundreds of new staff. And the nurses and practitioners from all over the world that would come and work in Ireland, it's nothing got to do with salaries. It's nothing got to do with all those things. Nothing got to do with taxes. It's got to do with the crisis that the health service is in.
They
don't want to come and work in a place where one nurse has to do the work of three of them, and that's what they're having to do here. And that's the problem we've got. It's an overall re-evaluation and reorganisation of the system that we need.
David Whelan says on Twitter, we need more hospital beds. We're still reeling from the savage cuts to the health service in the 1987 to 89 period, and thanks Fianna Fáil, is his message. What's wrong with universal public health service, free at the point of delivery, paid by progressive taxation, says Ciarán in Tralee. And one more, every year, Paddy says, we're told there is a contingency plan in place to deal with any winter spike. Fail to prepare, prepare to fail. Well, it didn't seem to work this year. Let's take a quick break. Back with more after this.
You're coming back.
big problem.
Welcome back to the programme. Peter Burke, Fine Gael TD for Longford West Meath is here. Martin Kenny, Sinn Féin TD for Sligo Leitrim. Dr Emily O'Connor, consultant in emergency medicine at Connolly Hospital. Martina Devlin, author and columnist with the Irish Independent. And Billy Kelleher, Fianna Fáil TD for Cork North Central and spokesperson on health, joins us from our Cork studio. A couple more on the health and trolley crisis. Liam Doran has said that spreading the patient load between A&E and wards is unacceptable to him and his members, says Anne in Galway. So Martina, well, your solution, the nurses don't like it, we're told.
I think it's fairer. The nurses in the emergency departments would prefer it. The doctors in the emergency departments would think it a bit more fair. I'm not saying it's a permanent solution, but it would certainly 10% overcrowding in a ward is better than 100% overcrowding in emergency, especially when research shows that if you spend protracted periods in emergency, your outcomes will be worse.
You would think. Let's talk about another issue now, which was making the news towards the end of the week. Balahadreen and the arrival in the next couple of weeks of Syrian migrants, 80, to the Abbey Field Hotel. I was just interested to talk about this, Billy Kelleher, because I see you tweeted, we should remember the lifeless body of Syrian boy Alan Kurdi before we say no to refugees in our communities. We are a decent people. Why did you feel that you needed to say that?
Well, I can remember debates some years ago in my own constituency when asylum seekers at the time were being housed in hotels, and there was a lot of opposition, and a lot of it was inflamed opposition and stoked up opposition. I was very conscious of my role as a public representative that, you know, we had to house our fellow human beings in times of crisis and in times of catastrophe in their own countries. And I just feel at times that, opposition to these things can just garner so much support very quickly that the real issue is lost, and that is the fact that these people have come from the most appalling, war-torn conditions, and that we should be reaching out as best we can. And
do you think that there has been an overarchingly negative reaction to the arrival of the Syrians to Balahadreen?
Well, it's not to Balahadreen. I wasn't referring to Balahadreen at all at the time. It was just nationally itself. I just remember the time when, for example, the government announced that they would bring in 4,000 Syrian refugees. You still get people in the street that would say to you, why don't we look after our own first?
I saw a lot of comments actually online. I was looking at the journal.ie yesterday. They had an article about this, and a lot of the comments were saying exactly that.
Yeah. And like, look, I mean, I don't have any greater grasp of, feelings than anybody else. But I mean, that image of that little boy, Alan Kurdi, being washed ashore in an island in the Mediterranean was, really struck a chord with me, and I think with most other people. And I just feel that, we should be sensitive to what these people have gone through. Mm-hmm. And it's not Balahadreen. It could be, any community. I can understand the concern sometimes because the Department of Justice and others who are involved in this don't necessarily, engage in an open way. And we did that in Cork. We had them in Glentown and elsewhere in my own constituency, where we set up community groups to sort of liaise, and meet the asylum seekers and interact with them, and we had support groups, and it worked very, very well. I don't think any community no community is the poorer for these people coming. It enriches them.
But you've got to bring people with you. I mean, the Department of Justice telling the people of Balahadreen on Thursday that this was happening within 10 to 15 days. The hotel was renovated, I understand, in the summer. Martin, you might know. I know it's not in your constituency, but it's close enough. Yeah. The hotel was renovated in the summertime. Yeah. So people expected that that was going to open as a hotel and bring much needed business. So they might not be opposed to migrants coming.
A lot of it is that. A lot of it is that they felt this hotel was going to open again. Tourism was coming back. Things were improving.
A lift for the town.
The Atlantic Way and all that stuff. And they hoped it was a lift for the town. Then they heard instead of that, it was the refugees were coming. And, in fairness, they are generous people in Balahadreen and everywhere else in the west of Ireland. It's not about that, I don't think. And there are many examples. And I know in Carrick and Shannon, for instance, we had a Kurdish refugee programme where there were programme refugees came. And it was perfectly integrated, works very well. They have become part of the community and part of society and has worked wonderfully. And there are many other examples of that been done properly around the country. But I think just the way it has happened initially has sort of put people off, because it has, as you say yourself, has bounced on them very quickly, and there wasn't enough consultation. It wasn't done as well as it needs to be done. And I do think that the big issue for most people in Balahadreen was that this hotel, which is the only hotel in the town, was going to be something that was going to be an asset to the town. And now they feel if it's going to be refugees in it, that's possibly not going to happen. I think it's coming from that point of view rather rather than any absence of generosity or humanitarian response to the refugee crisis, which all of us have, and as a society, Ireland always has had. And Peter, I think as a community that have sent people to all corners of the world,
Martin,
we have to have.
I just want to say,
Put on your headphones there, because
in Cork North Central, we had in the past, and you do see it from time to time across the country, where some people try to stoke these particular issues and fears, and they try to harness them for their own purpose. And that type of movement, anti-immigrant movement, is sweeping across Europe. And I'm just making that point. It's nothing to do with the people of Ballardreen or any other part of this country, but it is just something that we should be conscious of, that, for everyone that wants to embrace people that are coming from war-torn areas, there are others who don't, and we must be conscious of that and make sure that they don't get traction. And, the Department of Justice, the way they handle these things, obviously plays into their hands, and they should be more open and transparent and asking communities to embrace people rather than, this foisting on without any consultation, I accept, is a big problem.
Peter, what do you think?
I think anyone who saw the recent special on RT in relation to the Mediterranean and the great work that was done there realises that you do need to facilitate people who are coming from war-torn areas. And I would point out that Senator Maura Hopkins was on radio, I think, yesterday, and she was making a very valid point that, having people coming there is one thing, there's no issue with that, but you need supports available for them. You need notice. And I think it's not acceptable to go in a manner whereby you're getting less than 24-hour notice that people are coming into the area. I think you should be planning it, and it should be carried out more efficiently.
So the Department of Justice was wrong in this instance?
I would be concerned, and I would tend to agree with Senator Hopkins' analysis on it. I think there should be more supports available and detail to the people to show what supports to bring them into the community and make them feel welcome. I think that should be very important.
So this is an issue for Frances Fitzgerald then, is it?
I think it's an issue for the department going forward that we've agreed to the 4,000 number. It's an issue for the minister going forward that we've agreed to the 4,000 number, but we need to ensure that it's in a planned manner to ensure that those people get every chance, that there's supports available there. And maybe that is the case already, but that needs to be explained to people. I think that's where some of the concern comes from, because some people in those localities believe, what supports are there. There's some areas have very small populations where people are coming into them, but your heart would go out to the circumstances that a lot of these people have come from.
And a lot of people in Ballardreen, speaking to reporters, had said that these people are very welcome. I think it was just, again, it was the manner
exactly
and how it's done. Martine, do you have a view on it?
I think it was very discourteous to do it in that manner. You can understand why a local population would want a hotel, would think that it would bring tourists, that there would be some discretionary income that therefore is spent in Ballardreen, some jobs possibly, and all this is now a pipe dream for them, obviously. Equally, the Irish gene puddle needs to be enhanced a bit. We're still far too monocultural, and I think it can only be an advantage to have people from other cultures, and Syrians are very clever people. We're lucky to get them.
We have a text message from Bernie who says, or a Twitter message rather, refreshing to hear realistic discussion of Ballardreen issue instead of random accusations of racism. And that's often what happens when you discuss these issues. I want to take another break in just a moment, but before I do, Martin, I want to ask you about concerns, as I see here in the Irish Independent, about Martin McGuinness's health. Okay. He has not been seen in public since before Christmas, says this report, and the party Sinn Féin had a big event yesterday at Stormont, a press conference outlining their cash for ash proposals into that inquiry, and he wasn't there. Do you know what's going on, or how is he?
Well, I'll be absolutely honest with you, I don't know. But I do know that he has got a health issue that he's dealing with at the moment, and it's something, I suppose, that all of us as we get on in life, as we've been talking about early on, will come across health issues, and he has a health problem that he's, I suppose, receiving some form of treatment for. I don't honestly know. I haven't been told and I haven't asked, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that the operation of government in the north is continuing. Unfortunately, there's a crisis developing there at the moment, and we hope to get, I suppose, some progress with that over the medium term. But, it's quite likely that we could be looking at elections in the north coming maybe in the next couple of weeks.
Okay.
But Martin McGuinness's health is obviously an issue, but I don't think it is, certainly not the crisis that we're facing.
Okay.
I think the crisis is in the government.
Is it a serious issue?
I don't know. I don't know, to be honest with you. I'm not trying to hide away.
Okay.
I don't honestly know.
All right. We'll take a quick break. More after this. Now, we're going to talk about this poll which emerged during the week. It's fascinating. So if Leo Varadkar were the leader of Fine Gael, the party would win 13 more seats, or 36%. If Simon Coveney were leader, Fine Gael would win 31%. And if Francis Fitzgerald were leader, Fine Gael would win 29%. But I think where this gets really, really interesting in a kind of a nerdy way is how this would impact Fianna Fáil. So if Enda Kenny stayed in power and if an election happened now, Fianna Fáil would gain 12 seats. So that's great if you're in Fianna Fáil. Under Mr Coveney, Fianna Fáil would gain 7 seats. But under Leo Varadkar, Fianna Fáil would lose 2 seats. Billy, it's worrying times. Leo Varadkar must be kept out at all costs.
No. That's entirely a matter for Fine Gael. I don't know how scientific or how broadly based this particular poll was.
1,029 people.
But you're going to have you know, this continual jockeying over the next period in Fine Gael, while there's uncertainty about who's going to replace the leader of Fine Gael, who happens to be the Taoiseach as well. But from our perspective as a political party, we've signed up to a supply and confidence agreement with Fine Gael. It's a written document. As long as they abide by what's in it, we'll support whoever is there.
Oh, right. So there's nothing in that deal, is there, about the leader, about who should be leader?
Well, we can't be prescriptive on that. I mean, you know, that is a matter for the Fine Gael party. I mean,
but there's no clause that says this is all grand until you change your leader, and then we'll have to talk about it.
There certainly isn't a written clause anyway, Claire.
but you'll certainly be thinking about it if it does happen.
Well, look, I mean, all political parties, let's be honest, I mean, we all are political in our outlook, and we all try to take advantage when something comes your way from a party point of view. But I mean, like, we have committed to 3 budgets, and we intend to honour that, provided it's honoured from the other side as well.
Mm-hmm. There'll be,
of course, the person who's most annoyed with all of this has to be Simon Coveney. I mean, you know, next week there'll have to be a poll done that will show the other way around, otherwise it will be a one horse race.
I was reading Dermot O'Hearn, who was writing in the Mail today, saying that Fine Gael got rid of Michael Noonan for John Bruton based on a bad poll, so don't discount this, is what he's asserting.
Well, yes, but there is a dynamic within Fine Gael at this stage, and there's no doubt. I mean, it is a case of when as opposed to if. The difficulty, of course, in moving is that the person who normally moves does not necessarily wear the crown thereafter, and that's going to be the difficulty for, you know, whoever wants to take the Taoiseach out in terms of leadership of Fine Gael. And that's always a difficulty. And
we had Michael Fitzmaurice here who explained beautifully last week how, you know, the person who wields the knife would not be made king, but that would all be taken into account, and that person would never expect to become king. So that would be sorted internally before
any moves
were made.
So there has to be a stalking horse for us.
There'll have to be a stalking horse. Yeah, we've got it all figured out. Peter, when is all this going to happen?
Well, first of all, I would say that there is no vacancy in Fine Gael. The Taoiseach has the experience at the moment to lead the party and the country through this uncertainty, through the Brexit conditions. Obviously, Theresa May has indicated that Article 40 or 50 may be triggered in
That's
March.
All lovely, but look, you're looking at this and you're going an extra 13 seats under Leo Varadkar.
The point I would make is that there is no TD in the 32nd Dáil who has the experience both domestically and internationally than Enda Kenny. I think we need his contacts in Europe in terms of the difficult negotiations we're going to be going through now over the number of weeks and months, and I don't see that changing in the short term. I would point out, though, in relation to the poll, I think Fianna Fáil's polling data must be showing the same thing, because they're continuing their monthly attacks on Leo Varadkar. When he was a guest presenter here over Christmas, Willie O'Dea came in and attacked him over it, and it transpired that back in 2008, when Willie O'Dea was Minister for Defence, he was guest presenter at 95FM's breakfast show. So that's huge hypocrisy, you can see.
There you go, Billy.
So you're obviously, Peter, you're backing Deputy Leo Varadkar, or Minister Leo Varadkar, so I see, for the leadership stakes.
No, there's no cat out of the bag.
He brought you out for pizza and beer, is that right, in the summertime after Westmeath were in the Leinster final?
Look, I know Leo Varadkar a long time, like many contacts I have in Fine Gael. I meet people regularly for something to eat, for a drink, so there's no issue there. Like, I think people exaggerate these things.
So that wasn't an unusual event, because it was reported in the papers as him, you know, going around making sure everybody was his friend.
No, but that's definitely not the case. I think every candidate who potentially goes forward for leadership are going to be watched in terms of what to do, who they're with. I think it gets too intense, and people do read into things that are not the case at all. I think we want to be very clear on that.
Okay, so you all buy each other pizzas and beers after Croke Park.
Definitely.
Games,
but, yeah.
Nobody that
especially,
easily bought.
Especially when your team loses in Westmeath, unfortunately, that day in an Leinster final.
Martina, what is it about Leo?
Oh, he's box office, isn't he? He's got va-va-voom. I tell you what, he's a straight talker in the public like that. If you ask Leo a question, he will always give you a straight answer. And that is not as common as you might hope, you know? So, but what I find fascinating...
I would argue that he might appear to give you a straight
answer. Well, all right. Yeah, but there are nuances. You're absolutely right. But I think that Leo said to me once that... and he didn't buy me pizza at the time either, but... he said to me once that what the public like in him, i.e. his straight talking and his honesty, is not necessarily an asset with party members. They sometimes don't like that. And so he said that you couldn't necessarily assume that you're popular with the party because you're popular with the public, and it is, after all, the party which decides who's going to be leader.
But if you're a party member, and particularly if you're a TD and you see the extra seat tally, that's all that matters.
Well, yes, possibly.
And the other thing is Simon Coveney, does he not appear to be a straight talker and somebody who is very forthright?
I think he's
What's
performing.
The difference?
I think he's performing very well, you know.
But he's not rating as well as Leo Varadkar. I would love to get to the nub of that and what the difference is.
Well, it's box office, isn't it? Look, you know, popularity, the backstory with Leo's very interesting,
Donald
isn't
Trump
it?
Is box office as well, isn't he?
Billy Kelleher has just said that Donald Trump is box office too. But nobody here is comparing Leo Varadkar to Donald Trump.
I'm just making the point that box office isn't necessarily always equal to substance. I'm not referring that to Minister Varadkar, but I'm just in general, box office, you know, you can't measure it in terms of how a party would view it internally, you know, in terms of leadership stakes, be that for any political party.
But it's what the public thinks of him.
Of Minister Varadkar, yes, but the point I'm making in terms of a party internally, you know, there's many more dynamics that are at stake here.
Which is what Leo said himself, yes, you know. Yeah.
So how will when will all of this play out? I mean, it's fascinating to watch it and we get all of these numbers through, but what will provide the ultimate push here for any of these candidates?
Polls, will it be polls? Is Micheál Martin watching the polls and...
No. We don't watch the polls. What we do is watch the policy that's being implemented by the government, and if it's in accordance with our supply and confidence. The polls, though, in recent years have been inaccurate in lots of cases. We've talked about in the context of Brexit and the United States, but also even in the last general election as well. They were out quite a distance in terms of assessing the change in the mood in the public in the last number of weeks in the general election as well. So I think one poll on this particular issue, you know, is... it's a bit lightweight in terms of, you know, making adjudication. I think you need to see a few more polls. And I can assure you, you know, polls versus the internal dynamics of political parties, observing politics, you know, not only in my own party, but across, I suppose, Ireland and the globe, are totally different as opposed to what the public think and how a party elects a leader, particularly when it's a college system, parliamentary party members, councillors, and in the broader membership. You know, they have varying views and different agendas.
But isn't the real issue that Enda doesn't want to go?
Well, of course, the Taoiseach doesn't want to go, and I'm quite sure that, you know, every day he's there, he feels that he's making a contribution. And that's what I find fascinating about this whole debate from one remove in many ways, is that he holds all the trump cards, because there's two pretenders, we'll say, Minister Coveney and Minister Varadkar. And, you know, whoever tries to push first will certainly, you know, feel that they could lose the people who would be loyal to Enda Kenny as leader Fine Gael, and that puts them in a very difficult position. So it's not in their interest at the present time, either one of them, to show their hands in terms of wanting to wield the sword.
But there's another person whose name wasn't even mentioned in this poll, which amazes me, and that's Pascal Donoghue.
Yes, the dark horse, yeah.
Well, he continually rules himself out, so I assume by that he's firmly ruling himself in, you know.
I think he's performing well. He's keeping spending under control. That's his job.
Have our politicians the stomach for an election in 2017, Martin? Would you be up for it?
Well, have the people? I don't know.
No.
I don't think the people have, really. And I suppose, you know, like, as in fairness, there's supposed to be a 3-year deal there. Really,
but you heard what Billy said. Yeah, I mean, that would all be reconsidered. What I'm reading into what you're saying, Billy, is that would all be have to be reconsidered if there were a leadership change.
I'll be very clear. If the leadership changes and if the leadership continues to implement the agreement, well, then there should be no reason for an election. If you have a new leader that comes in and decides to tear up an agreement that we have with Fine Gael in terms of the supply and confidence, well, then that is problematic. But if they come in and they seamlessly implement what's already agreed in terms of our programme with Fine Gael, well, then there shouldn't be any difficulties.
But the real issue here, you know, and it's this popularity contest sort of thing about leaders and all that is one thing, but really when we go back to the discussion we were having at the very beginning of the programme, and indeed for a lot of it, it's about policies, it's about, you know, the analysis that a political party has or a political group can have about how they can create a better future for our children and our children's children. That's really what it has to be about, you know, and we can talk all we like about, you know, who's in charge and who's the person that will get the most votes or will get the most seats and all of that, but really what will make the difference for the people is about the policies that will be implemented and the policies which is about dividing the cake that we have in a better way to ensure that everybody gets a fair crack of the whip.
And our medic was nodding in agreement.
Yes.
All right, we'll leave
saying
it there.
Nothing.
We'll leave it there. We were out of time, but thank you all very much indeed for joining us in the programme. Billy Kelleher in Cork, Peter Burke, Martin Kenny, Martina Devlin and Dr. Emily O'Connor here in Dublin. We're back with you next week and back on the television Monday night at 10:35. I hope you can join me then.
Saturday with Clare Byrne was produced by Kay Sheehy. The broadcast coordinator is David Phelan. Research is by Simon Gallagher. And on sound today, Sheila Neveal.